From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Well, let's jump right in. Maybe a couple of reports on some of the local activities there, and then we can go to some of the bigger issues, including looking at the role of Bolivia at the United Nations this past weekend, and generally.
Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting issue. And before we get into all that, and there are a couple of things, a couple of corrections I need to make about remarks that I've made in previous conversations, really just footnotes. One is that I just, without paying much attention to it, I just assumed that the Brazilian election was going to be late July, early August, but it's scheduled for October. And the other error that I've made in past conversations is that I just assumed that the legislative elections in Venezuela would be held quite close to the presidential elections, because that's the impression that was given a couple of months ago by the head of the, by President Maduro. But it turns out that there's no fixed date for the legislative elections in Venezuela.
Yeah.
The presidential elections are on May 20th.
Right.
Anyway, so I'm sorry for those minor errors. So then a couple of things that are interesting in kind of sub-regional terms. And here in Central America over the weekend, there was a referendum in Guatemala on whether or not Guatemala should take a territorial claim against Belize to the International Court of Justice in Holland, in The Hague. And the yes vote won that, but with an incredible level of abstention, 76% abstention.
Really?
So, yeah, it's not clear at all what the, how legitimate, or, most people in Guatemala obviously couldn't care less. And actually, the territorial claim against Guatemala seems to have been settled long ago in a treaty between the Guatemalan government and the then colonial authority, the United Kingdom. But let's mind that may be something to follow in months to come. Anyway, the other thing that's going on that is of interest is the election in Paraguay. That's I think it's scheduled for next Sunday. This is quite interesting for me because of the election result in Costa Rica recently, which is very similar in a way. In Paraguay, there are only two candidates, the traditional candidate of the right-wing party, the current president Horacio Cartes' party. In the polls, he looks as though he's the favorite, but I doubt that. His opponent is the traditional Liberal Party candidate, the candidate of the traditional Liberal Party, supported by former President Fernando Lugo's Guasu Alliance. So now that election in domestic terms isn't very interesting, because just as in Costa Rica, domestic policy is unlikely to change very much. But it could be significant at a regional level if a candidate more sympathetic to Venezuela, and he should be if he's supported by Fernando Lugo, does win that election, and Paraguay might then not be a reliable right-wing ally either for the United States an international level, or internally in South America for the Mercosur giant Brazil and its ally Argentina, who will then find that both the smaller countries within Mercosur are led by relatively progressive governments who are not amenable to an all-out regional assault in diplomatic and economic terms against Venezuela. So that could be significant after next Sunday.
Yeah, it's been 6 years since Lugo was yanked out of office, right? It was like 2012, I think, somewhere.
That's right. I think it was 2012. Then subsequently the following year, Horacio Cartes won the election. mainly because the opposition was in complete disarray, because the Liberal Party back then that had been supporting the government of Fernando Lugo betrayed him and voted for his removal.
Right.
So they patched all that up.
Yeah, well, Franco was president for like a year. He was the vice president, and then Cortes took office in I think was elected in 2013 under those conditions. With the right. You know, you essentially had the people who had engineered essentially a coup, a quote unquote constitutional coup.
It was very much a prototype for what's happened subsequently in Brazil, for example.
Yep, exactly. Yep. So, go ahead.
So then, there's lots of other stuff going on, but I think we should try and talk if we can about the Americas Summit in Peru, the 8th Americas Summit.
Yeah.
In Peru, and I don't know, even if it was reported very much in the United States, it should have been, because there was the presence of the U.S. government in the form of Vice President Mike Pence, because Donald Trump was busy sending missiles into Syria.
Right.
So the significance of that summit is that it was very largely a failure in terms of the United States' attempts to galvanize more support against Venezuela, because that is the fundamental policy priority for the United States in Latin America at the moment. And they failed. Mike Pence had to sit through a categorical drubbing in verbal terms from the Cuban foreign minister Bruno Rodriguez, and if I have time, I'd love to translate that and post it somewhere, because it is a classic kind of taking apart of United States, of the absurd United States positions on Cuba.
Well, you know, the summit, just for so our listeners are aware of the fact, the summits of the Americas are essentially a product of the OAS. In other words, the U.S.-led, organized-based hemispheric organization that was essentially operating for many years as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy and enforcement of the Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere. The summits of the Americas operate under the auspices of the Organization of American States.
Yeah, and the first summit was back in, I think, 1994 under Bill Clinton's presidential administration in the United States. And that was, I think that was actually held in Miami.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember the periodicity with which they're held, but this one was the 8th.
Yeah, it's every 2 years. You had Miami in 94, Santa Cruz, Bolivia, 96, Santiago, Chile, 98. Quebec City, Canada, 2001. I don't know what they skipped a year. Mexico, Monterrey, 2004. Mar del Plata in Argentina, 2005. Port of Spain, Trinidad Tobago, 2009. Cartagena, Colombia, in 2012. Panama City, 2015. And now this one in Lima for 2018.
Right, and of course the one in the summits prior to the Mar de Plata summit were designed to prime the region for the United States strategic free trade area of the Americas.
Right. That's right. Which failed. And,
in 2005, that was totally blown out of the water by, as we've said in previous conversations, by Lula da Silva, Brazil, Nestor Kirchner of Argentina, who was the president of Argentina at the time, and of course Hugo Chavez Frias, the president of Venezuela, and they just put together a consensus in the region completely rejecting that free trade model, the so-called free market model.
And Correa and Ortega and some others too.
Right, of course.
But those are the prime movers though you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, and you're absolutely right to say that the Summit of the Americas is essentially an expression of whatever the configuration of power is As regards the organization of American states in the region. And it was very interesting to see that, we can talk more about Bolivia later, but it was interesting to me that a couple of weeks before the summit, there was an ALBA meeting of foreign ministers that rejected the legitimacy of the summit because one of the main controversies around it was that former President Kuczynski, who had to resign because of accusations that he'd taken bribes from the big Brazilian company Odebrecht, and he withdrew the invitation to Venezuela. And at one point, Nicolas Maduro was thinking that he might attend anyway, but he decided not to, as did various other presidents. And it was the summit of the Americas with the least number of presidents from the republics of Latin America and the Caribbean,
including Trump. Trump didn't go. He sent Pence. Sent Pence. I mean, it's like sending a chimpanzee with an organ grinder.
Right, sure. And Pence has very little credibility in the region.
Yeah.
And Trump has even less as a result of his outrageous policies against Mexico. And so the theme of the summit was democratic governance against corruption, that thing, which is, it's such a joke that you have attending that summit, Michel Temer and Mauricio Macri, who are two of the most corrupt leaders in the whole region.
Well,
and there they were pontificating about corruption and its threat to democracy in the region, as if they are Democrats.
Well, this is what we've seen. There was an ideological struggle around the world, but in the region in particular, beginning perhaps in 1917 or earlier, but certainly in the post-World War II period and after the Cuban Revolution in January 1st, 1959, whatever date you want to start that. And it appeared for a while, when they had suppressed Allende and some other things militarily, Guatemala in the early 50s, etc., that these guys won, that they won the positions of power, and even if you were to believe the media here, that they won the ideological struggle. That has completely and totally changed, and now they don't even engage in ideological discussion anymore, but rather it's about morality. It's about, yes, the problem is corruption, and what follows from that is the larger the state, the more of a magnet it is for corruption. So the only way they can sell this laissez-faire capitalist model that they like to impose, laissez-faire for us, and of course they have complete control of everything, is by saying that if you give anyone power to protect you, they're going to steal your wallet. I mean, that's kind of the logic of it.
Yeah, and that's the kind of strategy that the United States has been implementing for some time now, and kind of under the radar, as it were, because it wasn't clear until the coup against Fernando Lugo back in, as you said, in 2012, and that the subsequent development of that modality of undermining democratic governments via the judicialization of politics. And I over the weekend, I translated another article by the Misión Verdad website in Venezuela that directly addresses that issue and points out that, as you and I have talked about in the past, there are within the United States alliance with its local elites, there are discrepancies and contradictions. We'll also talk about that if we get a chance when we move on to talk more precisely about Bolivia. What the article points out is that what the United States is doing is that whereas in the 1970s and early 1980s it relied on the military to discipline and keep in line the region's countries, they are now using and exploiting and abusing and undermining the integrity of the judicial powers throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. And we'd seen the way that's happened in Argentina, in the case, for example, of Milagros Sala, and the ridiculous accusations of high treason against Cristina Kirchner,
right,
that have now thankfully receded. And also we've seen it in Ecuador with the completely unjust imprisonment of former Vice President Jorge Glass, on the basis of no evidence whatsoever except suspicion that he may have had an improper relationship with people who were in jail based on evidence in relation to corruption accusations. And that in Ecuador, that is now being developed. They're now developing a case against Rafael Correa, supposedly for mismanagement of Ecuador's national debt, when, as Correa himself has pointed out, all he did was harmonize Ecuador's public accounts procedures in accordance with the protocols of the International Monetary Fund. You know, so and then, of course, we have the whole situation around first Dilma Rousseff improperly removed from power on the basis of no evidence whatsoever. And now we have the actual imprisonment of former President Lula da Silva also on the basis of no evidence whatsoever.
Right.
So it's a complete abuse and overthrow, if you like, of judicial integrity throughout the region. And that's that the United States is betting on that to be able to intimidate the local political classes, and not just the political leaders of the left wing or progressive forces and movements in Latin America, but also the right wing. And we've seen this
that's
in
right.
Guatemala, for example, and also in Brazil to some extent, where Michel Temer has so far managed to face down and outmaneuver the attempts to indict him on corruption charges.
Right.
And also we've seen this in Guatemala, where
with Jimmy
Morales is the president there, and he's managed to outmaneuver U.S. attempts to manipulate the U.N. Commission Against Impunity there, that has tried to work with local Jimmy Morales's local political enemies to indict him for corruption, so far without success. And we're seeing this also in Honduras, where there's a commission there against impunity, also I think it's an Organization of American States body, and they have they're in quite so far Juan Orlando Hernandez has completely outmaneuvered any attempts by them to undermine his control as the re-elected president, in complete contravention of Honduras's constitution. As the article, the Misión Verdad article points out, there's this profound contradiction between right-wing leaders who resent this effort to intervene in their political life when they feel that they've got it under control in their favor. Elsewhere in the region, the right wing and the centrist parties, social democrat style parties, are very enthusiastic about using this modality to attack their political enemies.
Right.
And it remains to be seen how successful that U.S. policy will work out over the next few years. I think it won't be successful, but it remains to be seen.
Well, I mean, what you have, in essence, you know, if you think of not a static model, but rather the historical development of the area politically and institutionally, and actually with the two operating hand in glove, you know, you had the various governments that were installed, in essence, by the United States over the last 50, 60 years, military juntas, the whole bit, what happened in Brazil, what happened in Argentina, what happened in Bolivia, what happened, you know, all over the region, and them falling off, Somoza in Nicaragua, you know, on and on and on. And then the conditions that, you know, gave birth to essentially leftish and or left governments being elected in a number of places there, and those policies being held out in front of the rest of the region and energizing a base for left politics across the region. Now, while that all happened, institutionally, you still have judiciaries that are products of the old regimes. They tend to be life appointments or much longer-term appointments. They're supposed to be instruments of stability. And so, if you're going to make mischief and, you know, use the levers of power that were based in the old relations, that's the place to go. And that's more or less what's been done. And it has the added benefit, as I mentioned before, of appearing to be non-ideological. So you don't have to come trying to sell an ideology that's been rejected by, you know, at least half or damn close to half where, you know, where they didn't elect the left of the people on the ground, and use it as some, instead, some moral or, you know, transcendent order that needs to be covered. In other words, you know, this corruption is bad for everyone. It's not ideological. That person's a crook, no matter what they call themselves. Get them out of there.
Yeah, and obviously, if you can use that strategy to marginalize your main political opponents, then the electorates have only a very limited alternative, which is the one that you want the one that you want them to vote for. So
right,
And if you look at that, if you look throughout the region, where in the region are countries immune to this kind of false strategy? Well, they're immune to it in Cuba, obviously.
For sure.
And they're immune to it in Venezuela because the Venezuelan constitution was completely overhauled in a 100% democratic way under Hugo Chavez Frias. You don't have that situation in Nicaragua, where the Frente Sandinista long ago saw that coming, and Daniel Ortega and his team deliberately trained up a whole generation of lawyers to be active participants in the country's judicial system. So they inoculated their judicial system against that kind of subversion.
Right.
In Bolivia, Bolivia completely overhauled its constitution again in a 100% democratic way under Evo Morales's government. And under their constitution, the judicial authorities get elected. And now that may change.
Right.
But so there too, you have a system that is inoculated against this kind of sinister attempt to subvert the judiciary that the United States has been able to implement successfully in other countries, most importantly in Brazil.
Yep.
So then, if shall we talk a bit more about Bolivia?
Yeah, Bolivia. So then, yeah.
Yeah. So Bolivia has a very special role in the region currently, both at a global level, because it's currently a member of the UN Security Council. It's one of the revolving members of the UN Security Council, and it played a very important role in support of Russia, and to a lesser extent China as well, but in particular Russia, given the current situation in Syria. And it was it expressed the progressive point of view, the radical point of view, the revolutionary point of view,
yeah,
from Latin America and the rest of the world within the UN Security Council.
Yep.
That's one example of its role at an international level.
Yeah, very, really strong anti-imperialist tone to it, like unequivocal.
Yeah, and that is directly down to Evo Morales and his colleagues David Choquehuanca and his vice president whose name I forget at the moment. They have a very clear anti-imperialist policy, both at a global level and at a regional level, it was interesting that Evo Morales, despite the fact that the foreign ministers had a meeting a couple of weeks ago in which they rejected the legitimacy of the America's summit in Peru, Evo Morales attended the summit, and Cuba attended the summit. Now, there are other reasons why those two countries decided to send high-level delegations to the summit. And one, in the Cuban case, they wanted to counteract the attempts by Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, to use the summit to attack Cuba via non-governmental organizations and
right.
so-called civil society. And in Evo Morales's case, he wanted to project at the highest level possible his rejection of Venezuela's exclusion from the Americas summit. But he was also taking advantage of his visit to Peru to engage in bilateral talks with the new Peruvian president who replaced Kuczynski, who had to resign as a result of corruption allegations.
Right, right.
but the other thing about Bolivia, so at a global level, let's talk about, if we've got time, let's try and talk about that quickly in a minute. But at a global level, Bolivia, of course, is also very prominent in the G77 plus China group, formulating trade and economic policy generally, and development policy in the United Nations. And also within the United Nations framework, they are very articulate spokesperson for majority world concerns around climate change.
Yep.
So at that level, Bolivia is playing a key role. And then at a regional level, as we can see in the event at the 8th America Summit in Lima over the weekend, and they're also playing a key role defending the progressive point of view and the progressive options on every possible subject against the current right-wing attempt to impose a neoliberal free market, a free trade for what that's worth agenda.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that is that in that summit, Evo Morales, and this points to the contradictions that we were talking about earlier on between US policy in the region and right-wing interests in the region. Right. Evo Morales consolidated an agreement with Peru about the transcontinental railway that is going to depart. Its starting point on the Pacific coast is the Peruvian port of Ilo.
Right.
Bolivia, it obviously plays a key role in that rail route because the route has to cross Bolivian territory and before entering Brazilian territory, reaching the Atlantic coast in the southern Brazilian port of, I think it's called Santos.
Right.
Anyway, and the mere fact that despite all the contradictions, all the diplomatic contradictions, all the political contradictions, all the ideological contradictions, and the mere fact that Evo Morales participated in that summit and took part in the negotiations about that transcontinental railway, which is going to be financed by China, of course,
right.
Indicates that the United States is far from having things all its own way in Latin America, despite the propaganda to the contrary in the mainstream corporate media.
Yep, absolutely true. And it's going to be interesting to see how that goes, because as Morales negotiates with Peru over regaining access to the Pacific Ocean, you know, physically, this rail link provides exactly that. It's a matter of what's going to be the political and governmental and economic environment in which the stuff gets transshipped through what is now Peru into Bolivia from the Pacific, really between China and Bolivia, because I'm guessing China is going to have a pretty loud voice at that table about what the conditions will be.
It's China's Belt and Road Initiative Latin America.
That's exactly right. And we're going to stop there. Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
You're welcome, Don. Thanks. Look forward to talking to you next week if we can.
Yes, we will. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.